This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
This from Geraint, Dr. Doctor. Yes. I've just looked at the Internet Movie Database page for Three and Out. The plot keywords include crushed under train, crushed to death, death wish, assisted suicide, die with dignity, terminal sickness, and slowly dying. Does Mark consider this to be an accurate summation of the film? That's it.
Yeah. The keywords function on the IMDb is fantastic, actually. That's very good. And there may well be other films for which the reviews are provided simply by doing the keywords.
That's all you need. Glenn Morton says, the good doctor's never been wrong so far, but if he doesn't give a good review to Iron Man, then he does not understand what makes a good blockbuster. We'll get to that fairly shortly. We'll do a box office top 10, then some travel, and then our first new release will indeed be the aforementioned first blockbuster of the summer. And that's Iron Man. At 10, happy-go-lucky.
Well, we have discussed this. Just because I find the lead character irritating doesn't mean that I don't think there are merits to the movie, but I do find the lead character irritating. I mean, I think Mike Leigh's a great filmmaker. I watch anything yesterday. I really like Eddie Marsden in the film. There is that just boundless optimism of Poppy, and I think you felt the same way.
Indeed, I did.
Was fairly unassailable.
Spiderwick Chronicles at 9.
I like it. It's a horror movie for kids. It's basically a Hammer movie for, you know, for the under 15s, and it's got big scary monsters and super creeps in it, and I liked it very much. I mean, I think it's actually one of the best kids movies I've seen for a while.
But don't expect to survive for long if your child is under 8.
No, but yeah, that's right. That was. But
I had to walk around.
You had to walk around, yeah. Because it is scary. It is scary.
Street Kings at 8.
I was off. No idea. I have to ask James King.
Well, you could have caught up.
What, since then? Been, do you know how many movies are out this week?
No. That's your job.
Lots. No, fine. Well,
really, that many?
Yeah, really that
well,
many.
Well, before next week, Street Kings.
Well, no, there's two that I haven't seen, so you've got to choose which one.
Why can't you see both?
Fine.
Thank you.
Love working for you.
Deception at 7.
It's a straight-to-video erotic thriller that happens to have wound up in a cinema because it's got them stars in it, like Ewan McGregor. And it has... The best review of it was by Philip French in The Observer, who said of Deception, it has all the allure of fishnet stockings and as many holes.
Does Mrs. Kermode agree?
She hasn't seen it yet.
But I thought that was her specialty subject.
Soft
erotic thrillers that go straight to video.
No, that's all done. No, but it didn't go straight to video. It's in the cinema. That's the point. It should have gone straight to video, yes.
Then she'd have seen it.
Yeah, probably.
Son of Rambo at 6.
I loved it. I think it's really, really good. I would encourage everyone who is slightly put off by the idea that, oh, you know, it's a kid's movie, therefore, because it's not a kid's movie. I mean, I think it has a young audience to some extent, but I think it's a grown-up movie. I think it's a film for 40-year-olds, and I really liked it. I thought it was very cute, very sweet. And it's really nice to see Garth Jennings doing what looks like the film he wanted to make, as opposed to Hitchhikers, which I think was the film somebody else wanted him to make.
Helen in Northolt said, went to see In Bruges this week.
Oh, yeah.
Liked it. Never seen Colin Farrell perform. Must be in a female minority on that one, because In Bruges is at 5.
Yeah, I like In Bruges with reservations. I think there are things about it that are very good. It's certainly Colin Farrell's best performance in a very long time. Martin McDonagh, I think, is a very interesting writer-director. There are times when it doesn't quite sustain its own momentum. There is really scabrous dialogue in it, which is laugh-out-loud funny, and people say things that you just can't believe you're hearing in the cinema. I don't think it has quite the stripped-down purity of Six Shooter, which was a short film that he made that was nominated for, it may even have won the Oscar. But it is, you know, it's a very interesting... If you're feeling dark, if you're feeling that what you want to see is something about how rancid life can be with a little bit of redemption at the end...
No one ever feels like that.
They do, the time. They do. You're just Mr. Happy. That's why you like U2.
See, the trouble is that you use Mr. Happy in two different ways.
I know.
And because you use Mr. Happy in the other way, you can't call me Mr. Happy, because I might take offence at that.
Okay.
What are you saying?
That occurred to me, but yes, you're right.
Fool's Gold at 4.
Which again, that was the other one that I haven't seen.
21 at 3, then.
You know, big... gambling just... it's a cinematic thing, isn't it? You know, people throwing dice, all high stakes, blah-de-blah, Kevin Spacey, everyone running around, took a bunch of money, totally in one ear and out the other, absolute piece of popcorn froth. I mean, not terrible, but fairly disposable.
The Eyes at 2.
The Eye... You said the Eyes.
The Eye is at 2.
Oh, the Eye is at 2.
Yes.
Right, fine. It is at 2. You are quite correct. This is a remake of the Pang Brothers movie. You've obviously seen the Taiwanese original. It's not
many,
quite...
Many, many times.
Not quite up to the standard of that. No. If you've seen things like The Eyes of Laura Mars and, you know, it's a well-worn idea. Somebody has eye transplants and sees the thing that the eye... It's got hands of all with eyes. And it's nothing like as scary as the original, although the original itself was fairly derivative. But it's okay. It's not terrible. It's not terrible. It's okay.
Forgetting Sarah Marshall is the UK's number one.
Yeah. That's just, it's, I mean, I think the whole Judd Apatow thing has run its course. The funniest thing in the movie is Russell Brand being Russell Brand, not being very much else. It's the same old story about schlubby guy sitting around on a couch having ridiculously glamorous girlfriends who give him a hard time. And, you know, it's just more Boise stuff.
John in Los Angeles says loads of stuff about how great you are.
Right.
Dear Simon,
you're going to pass over that, though.
Blah, blah, blah. Well, I'll give it to you, and you can frame it, and you can pass it around your family.
Thank
you. All admire you very much. Imagine my dismay, therefore,
yep.
He continues, on hearing the recent review of Forgetting Sarah Marshall. Are we now at the point that this passes for a film review? In the words of the man himself, this was a lazy piece of work, badly done. Everyone involved, i.e. Mark, should be thoroughly ashamed of himself. Mark's sole criteria for judging this film seems to have been his dislike for producer Judd Apatow, despite the fact that the film was neither written nor directed by him.
No, he's produced it.
Lots more.
Yeah, well, hang on. Excuse me. When a poster says, from the guys who brought you, I think I'm allowed to do that. It's just not... It's not a very interesting film. That's why when we got to, you know my... It's a heaving aside. It's... I mean, if you want me to sit here and take it apart...
Again?
It's kind of not really worth it. It's just not very remarkable. The most remarkable thing is that James King is quoted on the poster as saying that it's dangerously funny, which it... transparently isn't, and that Russell Brand is the funniest thing in the film, and he's just doing Russell Brand.
Okay, so what we get to now, having done the box office top 10, is the first new release. It's the first big blockbuster. We'll do Iron Man in just a moment.
I'll say one thing. It's not lazy, it's weary. That's what it is. It's weary. And he's right, actually. I feel, when the Sarah Marshall thing's happening, I just feel a bit tired.
You feel a bit tired?
When Sarah Marshall comes up, you just feel a bit like, oh.
Oh, right. It's the film that makes you tired.
It's the film that makes you feel a little bit tired, yes, but
still,
it's not lazy, it's weary.
James King's comment may be more accurate than the a deliciously twisted, hilarious British comedy with heart. It deserves to conquer the world, quote, which Brian in Manchester points out is on the Three and Out poster.
Who said that?
Simon Rose, BBC Radio. That's what's on the poster.
That would not be right, then.
Right, so we'll talk Iron Man in just a moment, but first of all, Nicholas Duncalf has the sort of disturbing... news of stuff that's closed. So this from Martin in Old Portsmouth, a regular. Dear Simon and Sprout Boy, so Iron Man, critics have thus far voiced their approval. Will Mark be joining them, or as ever, going his own way? An iconoclastic figure, standing apart, arms folded, chin thrust boldly to the fore, refusing to bow to the will of the herd, and refusing to talk to anyone who says that the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford is dull, self-referential tosh. I suppose it all comes down to how you see Robert Downey Jr. Is he a talentless, hapless, druggy shambles, or, as others think, a very talented, hapless, druggy
shambles?
Here we go. This is what Mark thinks. This is the review for Iron Man.
It's such a build-up, Simon. And what if I now just go?
Good.
It's all right. So you know, latest comic book adaptation, X-Men, Hulk, Spider-Man, Daredevil, Elektra, everything in comic books now making its way slowly to the screen, thanks to Marvel and all the rest of them. Directed by Jon Favreau, who started out, I mean, in things like Swingers, and recently directed movies like Zathura. And there's an interview with Jon Favreau in which he was asked what he sort of saw as his aspiration for Iron Man. And he said, well, you know, I really, really like what Christopher Nolan did with Batman Begins, and that's kind of what I'm... That set the bar very high. And he's right, it has set the bar very high, and there's no sense that we're getting near that bar because there isn't the depth or, you know, or the darkness of that in this, although I'm not entirely sure that it wants to be. It is on the sort of shiny, happy side rather than on the dark and murky side. So Robert Downey Jr., he, as you were formerly mentioning, is a hugely rich arms manufacturer, Tony Stark, inventor of the Jericho bomb. There's a lovely line at the beginning when he says... It's, you know, people say things that, you know, you want weapons that you never have to use. No, I make weapons that you only have to use once, which is very good. And then he goes out to the Middle East where he is bombed by his own weapons, taken captive by a bunch of terrorists who were armed with his own weapons and told to build them a Jericho bomb. Waking up in the cell after having been bombed, he finds himself with an implant in his chest, which is connected to a car battery. Now, there's some flummoxing here about exactly what this implant is doing. At the beginning, he's told that it's there because he's got shrapnel in his blood supply, and it's an electromagnet and there to stop the stuff going into his heart. He then redesigns it, and it becomes so much more than an electromagnet. In fact, it becomes the thing that powers a metal suit, which he then uses to get out of the Middle East, go back to America, where he decides that, in fact, the arms trade is, and this is all just set up, that the arms trade is a bad thing. What
this
he wants
is the
to
pre-title
do,
sequence.
Well, yeah? It's not the pre-titles, but actually, because the whole movie is really setting up the character of Iron Man, it's obviously laying out the terms of the franchise. So then he develops Iron Man, which is a flying iron suit, what can do lots of brilliant things because he's got this thing in his chest, and he tries it out in the first instance by going back to the place where he was kidnapped and doing away with all the weapons of his own that have fallen into the wrong hands. Here's a clip.
Hello.
Tony.
Who's this?
It's Rhodes.
Sorry, hello?
I said it's Rhodes.
Speak up, please.
What the hell is that noise?
Buddy, I'm driving the top down.
Yeah, well, I need your help right now.
It's funny how that works, huh?
Yeah, speaking of funny, we've got a weapons depot that was just blown up a few clicks from where you were being held captive.
Well, that's a hot spot. Sounds like someone stepped in and did your job for you.
Why do you sound out of breath, Tony?
I'm not. I was just jogging in the canyon.
I thought you were driving.
Right, I was driving to the canyon where I'm going to jog.
You sure you don't have any tech in that area I should know about?
Nope. Bogey spotted.
Whiplash, come in hot.
Okay, good, because I'm staring at one right now and it's about to be blown to kingdom come.
And you can guess what happens from there on in. Now, look.
I always, in a very childish way, find whenever people say bogey spotted,
I know,
it can be quite entertaining.
Yeah, I know. It's because
bogey's at 6 o'clock.
Yeah, well. I know. It's a different word in American, but there we go. So, here's the thing. Robert Downey is a contradictory character. On the one hand, he has been incredibly annoying in the past. There are films that he's made in which you just please stop doing that thing. And when all he does is, you know, I mean, I can talk, but he talks fast and ticks and, you know, and he plays crazies. I mean, he is, you know, slightly crazy himself anyway, and he plays crazy people. You know, there was that famous bit of footage of him saying that thing about when he was talking about addiction and saying it's like, you know, the gun is in your mouth and I like the taste of the metal. And you just think, you are completely nuts, aren't you? And he sort of parlays that into his screen role. So that's what he does. He does crazies. And occasionally it's really, really annoying, and occasionally it kind of gets away with it. And in this case, it's fairly well suited. I mean, he's funny, he's witty, and, you know, and all those other things, which actually, at the worst of everything going wrong for him, he wasn't any of those things. So he's quite watchable, although he is essentially just doing the Robert Downey Jr., which is like that. You know, that's how he talks. And, you know, and then it's like, just put in the words here.
That's the worst one you've done yet.
No, it's not. Okay, how does Robert Downey Jr. go?
I'm not. It's not my job.
He does.
Do you
it's a bit lower. It's like,
that sounds like a train.
Yeah, but that's it. That's what he sounds like. I mean, it's almost like you can take the words out, and there is just there's the tune. There's the tune of the Robert Downey Jr. performance. Then, next to that, you have the Gwyneth Paltrow performance, which goes. Because that's what that's right. That's exactly what Gwyneth Paltrow does. Doesn't matter who she's playing. Doesn't matter whether she's wearing 10-inch high heels, you know, dressed as a dominatrix. Doesn't make any difference. It's still Gwyneth. So, key central relationship in the thing between and wears a little bit thin.
No.
Then, coming in from the side, Jeff Bridges! And Jeff Bridges is brilliant. Jeff Bridges walks on the beginning of he's got shaven head and beard. You know, it's the head upside down arrangement. Which, as anyone who knows about, you know, the iconography of this thing, any guy who's got beard, shaven head,
bad guy.
Okay, definitely. He's introduced as a good guy, but clearly
straight away
he's a bad guy. And I love Jeff Bridges. I really love Jeff Bridges. I think he's just one of those people. I don't care what he's doing. I will watch him in absolutely anything. I mean, I just think he's a terrific screen presence, and he really chews the screen up as the good guy. He was obviously going to turn out to be the bad guy, and there's a good hour, maybe an hour, and you know, a little bit more of that character stuff kind of working. And it's fine. And then it all falls apart at the moment that Jeff puts on his own Iron Man suit and becomes the other Iron Man who's going to have the battle with him. And then it turns into Transformers. And then there is 20, 25 minutes of Transformers. And it's a real shame. But it's the compromise that so many of the comic book strip adaptations make, is that they have character ambitions. They understand that what's really interesting about these things is that it's the people trapped within the circumstances. And yet, because they're multi-million dollar huge things, they have to just end up with people hitting things. And there are some, I mean, I think in the case of what Christopher Nolan did with the Batman movies, I think he really managed to give you that sense that you've got incredible spectacle, but there's substance all the way through it. But with this, you really feel like, here's the stuff. It's not really deep, dark stuff. It's just fine. And then here's the 20 minutes of Transformers at the end. And then that'll be the beginning of the franchise. So it's what would be referred to, you know, by Roger Ebert as a waving thumb. There is there's a good hour that's okay, and there's, you know, a slightly less than an hour that's substandard, and it sort of ends up falling in the middle. But the, it's a shame, because at the beginning you think there is going to be something working, because you need Robert Downey Jr. has this rebellious presence, and it's kind of vaguely political, but not really. But then he gets in the same room as Gwyneth Paltrow, and then it's...
And then the Jeff Bridges...
Ha! Ha!
Glenn H. says, I, for one, enjoy seeing films that wallow in the dark bleakness of life.
Thank you.
Or whatever that commodian statement was that Mark said about In Bruges. David Dorset, I have, as a train driver, taken Mark to London from Brockenhurst many a day. Could you ask him to reply to my have a good day with a smile? Oh, the fame.
Well, here we are. You mean now? Or?
No, I think he says, when he says have a good day to you, could you smile at him?
I always smile at people when they say have a good day to me.
Well, clearly you've...
Clearly I don't.
Dave in Dorset, who's not feeling too pleased about it.
Well, I'm very sorry about that.
Excellent. If there's any other personal correspondence that people want to take part in, that's absolutely fine.
The surgery is open.
A pile of emails waiting to get through, but also we have to do some reviews before 4 o'clock. Joy Division, P2 and Nims Island, I would think, would be the minimum.
Yes.
Maid of Honour?
Yeah, well, I want to get to Maid of Honour.
We will try and do all of them before 4. It's 5 Live at 3:32. Groucho and Harpo, says Jack Blackburn. Thank you... to the good doctor for recommending In Bruges, which I thoroughly enjoyed, and for that matter, The Orphanage, which I saw some weeks ago and thought was brilliant. Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson were superb, and the film is the most fantastically sweary one I've ever seen
since
With Nail and I. Buoyed with a number of successes from my following of Commodian reviews, I followed the doctor's guidance and watched Rashomon, which was recommended as much as Vantage Point was criticised. Yep. Alas, I hit a disappointment. No. It wasn't quite on the Gordon Brown scale of disappointment, but a disappointment nevertheless. Perhaps it was my expectations. But frankly, when the medium was used to give the husband's evidence, I lost most of my faith in the film. So that's that. So we need to rush on.
Okay.
And talk about Joy Division.
Joy Division, which is a couple of years ago, or maybe a year ago, there was a movie by Reg Travis, a Cold War movie, terrible movie, which was called Joy Division. And I said, sadly, not about Joy Division. Now, a movie called Joy Division, which is about Joy Division, now coming on the heels of Control, which, of course, you know, launched Sam Riley, who was absolutely great, directed by Anton Corbin. This is a documentary directed by a guy, Grant Gee, who worked on, I think, Grant Gee, probably. And he worked on that Scott Walker documentary. You remember the guy who made the Scott Walker documentary came in? Fantastic,
yeah.
Scott Walker documentary. Anyway, so a documentary about Joy Division, interviewing all the members of the band. Interestingly, Control was based on Deborah Curtis's book, Touching from a Distance. She's notable by her absence from this, and instead we get Anique, who's the girlfriend, who, of course, you know, is the other side of that triangle. And all band members are interviewed, all surviving band members, obviously, along with Paul Morley, the great Bob Dickinson, and, of course, the late, great Tony Wilson.
I don't see this as the story of a pop group. I see this as a story of a city that once upon a time was shiny and bold and revolutionary, and then suddenly, 30-odd years later, is shiny and revolutionary all over again. And at the heart of this transformation is a bunch of groups, and one group in particular.
It's funny, isn't it? Anthony H. Wilson did have a way of talking that was absolutely remarkable. And when you see 24-Hour Party People and you see Steve Coogan doing that version of him, you realise that it was that incredible mix of, on the one hand, it's slightly Alan Partridge, on the other hand, it is, you know, deeply, profoundly philosophical. And, you know, he means it, and yet, you know, there's something ludicrous about him, and yet absolutely brilliant at the same time. And I think he is really sadly missed, and he's a very strong presence in this documentary. I thought it was a very good piece of work. Now, we've established already that I'm not the world's biggest Joy Division fan.
No, to the extent that you actually think the Concert Angels
were a better band.
Well, I mean, they,
no, I don't think they're more influential, just they're a better band.
Well,
they are probably more influential as well. So what you get here, I mean, if like me, you're interested in that period, because I was in Manchester in 1982, which of course was after this had all happened. And when I was at school, Joy Division were the band that everybody had to like. And, you know, I remember a guy coming to school who had a copy of that Sordid Sentimental EP, you know, with the great big gatefold sleeve, which had Dead Souls and Atmosphere on it. And it was like, it was like the holy grail of things to have, because there were only a very, very limited number of copies. And the amount of copies they printed was the year, the number was 60, whatever it is, was the year that the last year that the French had beaten English on the English soil. It was something terribly everyone knew.
Weren't Itchy and Scratchy involved in it?
They were involved in it. And I'm sitting there watching the documentary thing, despite the fact that I'm not the world's greatest Joy Division fan, I think this is a really, really good piece of work. It's very evocative. And some of the stuff that's the kind of the key thing in it is Joy Division made this incredibly doom-laden music that really did sound like, you know, ooh, staring into the bowels of hell. And yet, in the interviews, they were essentially very laddie. I mean, particularly Peter Hook comes across and is very, very sort of matter-of-fact about it. But you forget how young they were. There's a very, very well-handled thing which they're talking about after the death of Ian Curtis, which, of course, was the point which Joy Division stopped, but the point which New Order began. New Order then went on to become, you know, be bigger than Joy Division, you know, ever were going to be. New Order became, you know, one of the biggest bands around. And they're talking about their reaction to it and whether or not they were going to go to the wake. And Hookie said, no, I wasn't going to. I was going to go to the pub because I was a lad. That's what I did. And one thing that's very interesting is there's a lot of footage, cameras travelling around these bits of Manchester. I mean, Anthony Wilson's thesis is that Manchester's revival was in some way was sort of sparked.
Yeah. I mentioned that to Steve Morris when he was just last week. He thought it was
preposterous. Yeah, no, of course, because that's the thing about Wilson is that it was, you know, at the same time brilliant and ludicrous. And when the cameras are going around these places, they're saying, you know, look, grim, grimy, terrible. And at one point, they go down round the walls of Hume, the Hume estate, and the camera virtually pans past the front door of the flat that I lived in.
How thrilling. No, I missed that moment.
But what's interesting is this. There is this thing that on the one hand, there's the sound of Joy Division, and there are the pictures of Joy Division, and they sound like doom and gloom and, you know, bowels of Hades, and they look like, you know, somehow something that have crawled out of Revelations. And yet, the reality was they were lads, and if you look at that famous picture, the picture of them on the bridge, the flat that I lived in looked over that bridge, and of course, actually, it wasn't like that at all. It was really nice. And actually, one of the things the documentary gets really well, I'm going to stop saying actually now, I sound like I'm in the Socialist Workers' Party. One of the things the documentary does...
in the Socialist Workers' Party.
Oh, actually, blimey, yes, they do. Actually, if you actually look at what actually happened, you'll actually find that actually what Stalin actually did was he, and it's like, shut up.
Okay.
Anyway,
yeah, no,
the Socialist Actually Party, neither Washington nor Moscow, but somewhere over the rainbow. Anyway, what the documentary captures is that brilliant disparity between, on the one hand, the image, the sound, and the mood, and on the other hand, the reality. And as I said, as somebody who was there after the fact, I mean, I was there in 82 onwards, in that area, it was exactly like that. I mean, it has a great sense of place, a great sense of. So I think an awful lot of it is right about the mood of Manchester at that time and the influence of the group. It was lovely to see them all talking so openly. I could listen to Wilson talk forever and ever and ever, to be honest. Paul Morley comes out of it very well, says some very astute things. They talk about the artwork, and he's right. I mean, even I, as a Joy Division skeptic, looked at the front cover of Unknown Pleasures and went, oh, that is cool. No, that really is cool. And they talk about how that image was was designed and where it came from.
And also, we're seeing, apart, you know, if you've seen Control, you wonder where on earth that Ian Curtis sort of performance came from. Just to see him actually deliver that,
yes,
on stage, you think, I wish I was there. That would have been an extraordinary moment. Just to, I've never seen anyone do that.
No, well, I mean, because you've
or
seen
anything
the,
close to
no,
it.
I mean, you've seen the television broadcast. Okay, there are a couple of moments which directly mimic moments from 24 Hour Party People. There is the moment of Anthony Wilson hang gliding, which is at the beginning of 24 Hour Party People. There's the moment when he introduces the band on television. He says they're all from Manchester, apart from one of them who's from Salford. A very important distinction, and it gets that kind of detail right. I mean, it's loving. There's very little criticism. But it's a very interesting portrait of four very young people somehow caught in the middle of something that's bigger than all of them. And without saying they're the greatest band in the world, because, as you know, I'm not a huge fan, I thought it was a very moving documentary. And I just, my only criticism was I thought they were going to end by playing Ceremony, which is the New Order song that I like, and then they didn't.
They finish on Atmosphere, I think.
They finish on Atmosphere, yeah. which is kind of a little bit like, yeah, okay.
Martin in London, the good doctor, may well be regarded as witty by your dictionary guest, but then again, he does edit dictionaries, so maybe he doesn't take much.
Very good.
Ben in London, I'm not very well today, so I've spent all of it watching The Shawshank Redemption for first time since reading Dr. Kermode's book, and specifically his controversial rant about the ending. And I have to say, he's right.
Thank you.
I'm not going to create a Commodian... Oh, he says, I'm now going to create a Commodian copy of the film. P.S. Mark is thinking of Ren and Stimpy, not Itchy and Scratchy.
Thank you. That is what I'm thinking of. Yeah. Ren and Stimpy, not Itchy and Scratchy.
Clearly. But when you jumped in to accuse me of not knowing what I was talking about, how ironic that, in fact, it was
it
you.
It was that, yeah. Can I say one other thing about Joy Division? There's a lovely moment in which they're talking about Martin Hannett, you know, the incredible sort of legacy of Martin Hannett, and Hookie says, yeah, but he didn't write the songs.
We'll do P2 next, or do you want to do Nims Island?
P2 and Nims Island, and then May the
Honor. Three to do before 4 o'clock. So this is Nick Dunkoff. Actually, Tim in Croydon says, why does Nick conduct the travel with his hands? Please get to Maid of Honor, says Louise. I'm listening at my desk, being a lousy day. Have a feeling it might just brighten it up.
Well, let's get the other two out of the way. P2 is this off the pegs sort of horror thing.
Well, we don't have to get them out of the way. You can dwell if you wish.
Well, they, to be honest, they don't deserve that much dwelling. Alexander Ayo and Gregory Lavisser, who did Switchblade Romance, and it's directed by this guy Frank Calhoun, who was in Switchblade Romance. This is his directorial debut. It has a Christmas setting. Whenever you see a movie that's got a Christmas setting opening now, you always think, oh, fine, okay, because that means that it didn't do as well as it was meant to. In fact, it opened in America just before Christmas and made sort of very little splash. The story is, there is a woman in an office block. It's coming up to Christmas. She wants to go home. She wants to go and have dinner with her family. But she goes down into the car park to get her car, and she meets up with a weird crazy guy played by Wes Bentley. You remember Wes Bentley was the weird kid in American Beauty, and then he was in a movie called Weirdsville, and now he's in this as the weird crazy. It's like, you know, we're doing a movie, we need a weird guy. Is Robert Downey Jr. busy? Okay, is Wes Bentley around? Because he talks slower and he's a lot cheaper. And Wes Bentley basically invites her to have Christmas dinner with him, and she says no, so Wes Bentley then ties her up, and then there's lots of, and, oh, then he puts her in a dress. That's the thing, he puts her in a dress so that she can then do the rest of the running around in the car park in a very slightly sexy dress, as these kind of, you know, throwback 70s. And then there's running around with axes and calling the police and that sort of stuff. And it's very, very, you know, tab A goes into slot B. It doesn't do anything like Switchblade Romance did in terms of reinventing the formula of the 70s slasher movie. It just basically repeats it. It's some bits of it are quite nasty. Most of it's quite slick. It's totally in one ear and out the other and completely forgettable. Not bad, but just totally unremarkable. And remarkable only for the fact that it is literally like, oh, it is just another 70s slasher movie. It just happens to have been made now, not having been made 30 years ago. I mean, certainly the fact that she wakes up and she's in the dress, you go, oh, are we going to do that? You know, actually, think yourself lucky you didn't wake up in a negligee, because that, you know, if it was the 70s, that is what would have happened. So it's fairly unremarkable. But car parks, you know, there's standard setting for horror movies. Everyone thinks they're scary. I don't think they're that scary. And I don't think Wes Bentley's that scary either. But there we go.
Jeroen, I think that is, who says, sunny greetings from Belgium. I hope that there will be a review of P2 on today's programme. I'm curious to know how it'll go on the doctor's list of great Christmas films. It's definitely on mine, as the tone is right. There's a decent amount of gore. Elvis is on the soundtrack.
Yeah, there's a moment in which Wes Bentley, being weird, sings Blue Christmas.
And it takes place on Christmas Eve. What more could you want from any film? Clearly the answer to that
more.
Is an awful
lot more.
More.
An awful lot more. And then Nims Island. And here's the thing with Nims Island. Have you seen the trailer for Nims Island?
This is Jodie Foster.
Jodie Foster.
I've seen it many times.
Okay, from the trailer, just tell me the plot of the film.
I'm not sure.
Okay,
it looks like Swiss Family Robinson.
Yeah, okay, young girl on an island with her father, lives on her own. She reads these books called Alex.
Oh, Roger. Yeah,
he's right. An adventurer, right? Fine. And her father is played by Gerard. We are Spartans, Butler. And anyway, so the father goes missing, and the adventurer is going to come and go and help her, because the adventurer, actually Alex Rover, is in fact Jodie Foster, who isn't an adventurer. She's a, you know, she's a writer. And in fact, the gag is that she's terribly, she's very clean, doesn't go like, doesn't like airplanes, doesn't like adventure, doesn't like sea, doesn't like sharks, doesn't like any of that stuff. And so when the little girl meets her, she says, I'm Alex Rover. She says, no, you're not. She says, yes, I am. I'm her, right? That's all in the trailer, yeah?
Yes, it is.
That's the film. Then it stops.
It's well, it doesn't stop after 90 seconds, does it?
No, no, but it's the strangest thing.
Well, it's a bit more.
What else is there? Well, that's the end of the film.
You can't finish it there.
That is where it finishes. That is, the film finishes at that point. The trailer sets this thing up, and then the film stops. And it's so, look, I want to like it because, you know, Abigail Breslin is clearly very talented. I really want to find, you know, good kids movies with good, strong, you know, young, exciting, you know, girl leads, because I want to take my daughter to them. And the trailer makes it look like it's adventurous, and there's turtles and there's stuff and there's sea and there's all that kind of thing. And it's quite a nice little cute idea that Alex Trevor, but Jodie Foster is rubbish, 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 rubbish. Jodie Foster doesn't do comedy very well at the moment. I don't know what it is, because she was
kids films either, particularly. Yeah,
sure. Well, she's done a lot of movies with mothers and daughters. Very interesting. If you look at Jodie Foster's back catalogue, there's a lot of mother-daughter stuff going on in her thing. And there's a kind of mother-daughter thing going on here, because the implication at the end is that she's sort of going to become, you know, the new mother figure. But
have you got indigestion?
No, I'm sorry, just burping.
Oh, delightful. That's...
Well, no, but nobody else would notice other than you. I was making a, you know...
It was audible.
But I'll tell you what it was. That, in a way, was how I felt about the film. You're just sitting there going, it's just, you know, it is like an expulsion of air. There's nothing there.
Nicely worked.
Thank you very much. Jodie isn't any good. It's done by the husband and wife team who did Little Manhattan, which was that cutesy pop, you know, underage, you know, kids romance thing, which was, I thought was fairly toe-curling. And it's a shame. It's Walden Media, so they're the people who, you know, do the Narnia movies. And, it, you know, from the trailer and stuff, it looks like it's going to be fun. Then you sit there and you just go, oh, Lord, is that it? Is that really it? It's really quite boring. It's nothing much happens, and then it does. And Jodie Foster is just so not funny. It's a shame. It's a shame. If you've seen the trailer, you've seen the film. You don't
is it
the
kind of
the
film they have to go and see with a 10-year-old girl, and maybe they'd look at it completely differently?
Well, I think that there would be some appeal because, you know, young adventurous hero on an island, you know, with the animals and everything, all that stuff. But I want so much more than that for it, because I want to be able to, you know, take my daughter to see it and say, look, here's a great kids movie for you. And it just isn't. I mean, it just so isn't. And yeah, I really wanted to be right about this because, you know, Bridge to Terabithia, I think I misjudged, but it's just, it's limp.
Anyway,
lame.
We're getting to, we're eventually, we struggle on Maid of Honor. This is M-A-D-E of Honor.
Yeah, and that's Maid of Honor. What is that? Maid of Honor.
It's a joke, isn't it?
How is that a joke?
Well, because it's not Maid of Honor.
It's not.
M-A-I-D.
So the film is. Yeah, but I know that.
Well, that's the joke. But,
yeah, the joke is that it's a different spelling of maid.
Yes.
All right, fine. Well, here's
Did
how
that
you
really need to be. Explained
here's how you
to
make
you?
This. Well, no, it's just by maid of honor.
It's play on it, words.
No, but you can't. I don't. It doesn't mean anything. Anyway. So you take a little bit of When Harry Met Sally, you take a little bit of Four Weddings, you take a little bit of Best Friend's Wedding, take a little bit of anything which has got a wedding in it, you put all it in, and you remember Barbican, you remember those adverts for Barbican? Barbican is brewed like a true lager, but then they take all the alcohol out. It was Laurie McNamara.
It was.
This...
unbelievable football reference there from
thank you.
Never, ever heard before.
This is brewed like a true wedding movie, and then they take all the gags out. It's just terrible. And the story is Patrick Dempsey, who was really, really good in Enchanted, is this slime ball womanizing horror of a man, and he's got a girlfriend, a friend who is a girl, you know, just like in When Harry Met Sally, only not, because it's not funny. And she is his best friend, and now she's going to get married. She's going to get married, and now he wants to marry her, you know, just like that thing in Best Friend's Wedding, only not, the other way around, but not, because not funny. And she's going to get married in Scotland, just like that bit in Four Weddings and a Funeral, when Andy McDowell goes to Scotland to get married in the castle, only not like that, because it's the other person getting married, and it's the... And it's obviously a version of Scotland that has come off the back of, you know, a packet of biscuits and somebody watching Brigadoon once and saying, you know, yes, I had a glass of McEwan's once, let's set it there. So, and it's Kevin McKidd. Now, here's the thing. Kevin McKidd, great actor, like him very much, good, fun person. If you had a choice between marrying Kevin McKidd and marrying the other guy, Dempsey, you'd marry Kevin McKidd. There'd be no sense that you'd run off with a slime
ball. What was my choice again? I have to marry either Kevin McKidd
or Patrick Dempsey.
I wouldn't want to marry either of them.
Yes, you would. You'd want to marry Kevin McKidd.
Why?
Well, Kevin McKidd's family, they're the big Scottish... We're going to play a clip, we haven't got time. Big Scottish family. The gag is that when she gets there, she realises that actually she doesn't want to be part of this hunting, fishing and shooting thing. Actually, she loves Patrick Dempsey. Well, by this point, I want to slap Patrick Dempsey. At this point, I would run off with Kevin McKidd. I don't care how hunting, fishing and shooting his family are. In fact, the real surprise is that when it's revealed that Patrick Dempsey has become maid of honour in order to sabotage the wedding so that he can actually become the bride, the groom, the other one, just like in that movie, only not like in that movie because it's not funny, the hunting, fishing, shooting Scottish family don't stick his head on a pole and throw it in the Atlantic. They just all go...
Do you think that would have been a different film if they had?
I think it would have been a much better film, and it would have got a much bigger round of applause from the audience, who, by the time the film was ending, you know, were literally a head in their hands. And there's no gags in it. Kevin McKidd... I really like Kevin McKidd. He was the one in Trainspotting who didn't immediately get the breaks in the same way that Ewan McGregor did and all the rest of it. And he was... I think he's a really terrific actor, and I really... You know, he's been in that Rome... You know,
on
Rome.
The television.
On the television, him.
Big HBO BBC thing.
Yeah, and then here he is in Maid of Honour. It's not a gag. It's not My Best Friend's Wedding. It's not Your Best Friend's Wedding. It's not Four Weddings and a Funeral. It's not The Wedding Crashers. It's not nothing. It's just these scenes put together in this really bad, clumsy kind of way. And no gags. And then at the end, you're meant to feel happy that she ends up with Patrick Dempsey. I mean, I would have felt happier if small nuclear war had broken out, frankly.
Alex in Stirling, as I look down the movie releases for this week, I can't see a thing worth seeing. We've already seen Persepolis. I'm not sure...
Persepolis.
You said Persepolis.
No, it's Persepolis.
I'm not sure that happy-go-lucky is still showing, and we're utterly unconvinced that In Bruges is going to be any good. In the end, my wife will probably talk me into seeing either Iron Man or What Happens in Vegas. Both fill me with dread, but which is the least rubbish?
Well, Iron Man.
Straightforward answer, yeah. Alex and Sterling. What would you say is our movie of the week?
Joy Division.
Better than Iron Man?
Yeah. That's why I said it was movie of the week. If I thought that it wasn't, then when you'd said, what do you think is movie of the week, I would have said Iron Man.
Is it better than Reg and Stimpy? And Itchy and Scratchy.
Oh, go away. Yeah, I'm just not having this argument with you.
Have a wonderful weekend.
Yes, and you.
Get back tomorrow. No, we're not.
We're not even back on Monday. Rubbish at this.
Back on Tuesday at 1 o'clock. Enjoy the weekend. Drivers next.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.